Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to the Education Secretary. Rebecca Holcomb is joining us. Secretary, thank you very much for joining us. How are you this morning?
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Hey, before we get into the town meeting results, I just got a call about a concept here which I was not familiar with, but sounded pretty appealing on the surface, something called the flipped classroom. Are you hip to what this is all about?
Yes. I mean, that's an initiative that usually goes hand-in-hand with the one-to-one initiatives, which is a fancy way of saying that we give every student access to a computer or a tablet that they can use. And part of the purpose of it is to push things like lectures out of the class time so that the class time itself can be spent working on labs, working on hands-on activities, where you really want the teacher free to work in an individualized way with each individual student. So it's a way to sometimes teachers assign reading assignments, or they assign, maybe they pre-record a lecture and post it online, or they assign an assignment on Khan Academy if it's a math class, where students go home and their homework is really to view and take in that information out of class time, and then they come into class and they might work closely with the teacher to get individualized coaching, or you know, free up that time to do an extended lab so they have more time to actually do hands-on work in class with help.
Hmm. All right, so this is something that's ongoing here in Vermont.
Yes, it is, actually, in a number of districts.
Let's talk about the town meeting results yesterday. I don't have a firm number on how many school budgets got defeated. What's your count showing?
Well, it's not done yet. We haven't heard from all areas yet, but I think we've heard about 13 that went down. And then the rest seem to be, who knows, that will change a bit, but as results dribble in, but it doesn't look like we'll get the same number as last year.
All right, and what does that mean to you?
Well, I have to say, as someone who's worked in schools and in districts, it's a relief to me, because what schools need is some stability and predictability so that they can get down to the business of taking care of our children. And so it's reassuring that many of our districts seem to know what they're working with and are ready to go ahead and start getting ready and planning and moving away as executed. And that's good news. I think schools need stability and they need some certainty about what their resources are. It's difficult to plan and move forward. So I think that's the good news. What I don't think it does is really change some of the underlying fundamentals that we're dealing with. We still know that many of our districts were passing pretty bare-bones budgets. So that we're pleased that our communities are continuing to support education as much as they can. We also know that some of them are still struggling to provide what they'd like to provide in terms of opportunities, and some of these budgets are really quite tight. And that's a cause for concern, because it has implications for the quality of what we're able to offer our kids moving forward, and also for equity, whether truly students in every town are having access to the same opportunities. And it doesn't change the fact that we know that we still need to be looking at ways, given our declines in enrollment to date, but also our projected declines that in some areas will continue for at least 20 years, we need to continue to engage in these local conversations about how to best provide for our kids in a way that preserves quality. Two things that were different about this session, I think one is that from all reports that we've heard, the conversation is different. People agree that we have a bit of a spending challenge, but what's happening now is districts are really trying to figure out what they want to do about that. And we heard a lot more informed debate that was really focused on the data, focused on the number of students they were dealing with, looking at their situation with respect to phantom students, looking at what their population projections are moving forward, and trying to really think about, in that context, how do we make sure that all these precious education dollars that we're spending are truly going where they make the biggest difference, and that's in the classroom between the teachers and the children. And so I think that conversation is much more robust than it was last year, and that's been very promising. And the other piece that's different is we are seeing more conversation about partnerships on towns working together to try to create better opportunities for children. We had two merger propositions that were put forward. Elmore and Morristown are going to look at some kind of joint partnership or merger moving forward. And the towns of Bridgewater and Pomfret took a very, very important step in terms of voting for a joint contract school or joint district school. And that action was approved by voters in both towns, and it really, it closes a school in Bridgewater that's been the center of that town for 100 years. But what we see is that these two towns have had a very long and well-informed, courageous conversation about what they want for their children in terms of opportunities and what's the best way to work together with near neighbors to provide those, but in a way that's more affordable. And, you know, we were just struck that in doing this, the district is proposing to save about 24% of their combined individual budgets. Their per pupil cost in the new system should be about $11,710. Previously, it had been $16,564 in one district and $15,870 in another district. So they will be providing really more for their children at a much lower price by collaborating. And the other thing that they've done is they've managed to ensure that moving forward, both of those towns have voice in future decision-making regarding both quality and the cost of education. By partnering to operate, they've ensured that they continue to have some say in how their children are educated and how much it costs to educate them. And that's pretty stark contrast to some of the other areas around the state, which are really struggling right now with some of the costs around tuition. So it's, you know, it's interesting. I think that things are changing. When we look for patterns and we try to read the tea leaves about what this is telling us, what I'm hearing is that we do have some substantial challenges, but I'm seeing a much higher level of engagement locally in looking for solutions to address it. And I see that as very, very promising. And what those solutions will look like are going to be different. I think, you know, if you look at some of the budgets that went down, for example, in the islands, Grand Isle, North Hero, Alamont, I think part of the challenge is that they're just small.
Yeah.
And they may just need to look at, you know, what it would look like to go to scale. And, you know, there's some interesting proposals. I believe Isle of Mott agreed to consider designating a high school, which would help them control some of their costs. And I think they've also had some conversations about how to partner to combine forces and come up with some more sustainable solutions moving forward. I expect this to continue as we move forward. And, you know, of course, we're terribly worried about some of the towns that weren't able to pass their budgets, because we think that's, you know, it's hard for children, it's hard for the people working in those systems, and it's a burden on those towns as they have to continue to try to put together a plan which achieves their goals for their kids, but in a way that their voters can support.
Those two communities that you talked about combining schools and achieving that great savings. You know, I'm hoping this is a dumb, obvious question, but does that directly filter down to the taxpayers? Because, you know, I keep hearing these stories about efforts that communities make to decrease their costs, and then either the CLA or the per pupil cost or some other factor gets thrown in, and they wind up actually, the tax rate goes up when they're cutting spending.
Well, I think that, the quote about that this is going to save them 24% of their combined individual budgets, that comes directly from those districts, and that is what they're expecting to save. In terms of your latter question, you know, there's no question, and, you know, whether you look at the research or whether you look at the actual experience of places like Pomfret and Bridgewater, where literally there's been substantial declines in enrollment, and you could pick up the entire population of one school and drop it into the other without needing to build because they have the space, and that is true across the state in many, many areas. There's no question that this could be done more affordably to maintain the status quo. What we see in some of our communities is they've cut so hard already. They've cut out all foreign language. They've cut out arts. They've cut out music. They've cut out so much. They've cut out their media specialists that when you free up resources, when you do save 24% of your combined budget, what we see in some towns through local control is these towns decide that instead of returning that to taxpayers, the taxpayers actually vote to restore arts or restore foreign languages, programs that they've previously cut out, not because they didn't value them, but because, quite frankly, they just couldn't afford them. I mean, I think our voters do support our schools. I just think that many of them wish they could buy more with the few dollars they have.
Are you worried, you know, you talked about that this 13 or whatever number it winds up being is not an indicator that people should lose momentum here in trying to make some sort of changes. But, you know how human nature is. Aren't you worried that lawmakers are going to interpret this number significantly smaller than last year and maybe take a little bit of foot off the gas?
I think, you know, I just, again, these are our children, and nobody wants to play games with their children or their community's children. So I think that whenever voters can support the budgets, they know their school board members, they know people are trying to put together the best plan they can, given the resources they have. And so I don't think anyone willfully is introducing disruption to make a political point, you know, on our children's back. So I think that the fact that people are supporting budgets doesn't take away from the fact that we have some real structural challenges in the state of Vermont. We, you know, again, statewide, we have a 20% decline in enrollment. We're supporting the same infrastructure. The analogy we've been using is it's as if you had a big house for when your four kids live with you, and you've got the mortgage payment that goes with that big house. Your kids move out. You could say that you're going to live with two people in this big house and keep that same mortgage payment, or you could say that mortgage payment is too much and move into a smaller apartment. There are some communities that have lost, you know, they're serving, you know, one that's over 70% fewer students than it did 20 years ago. In a situation like that, you're paying the same basic price to maintain that overhead, but you're serving, you know, almost a quarter of the students you had. I mean, you're going to be paying a lot for that. And I think what voters are starting to say is we don't want to do that because we understand that this way of spending money isn't getting us what we want for our kids. And I think voters are frustrated when they see their tax rates going up, but they're buying less every single year. They're cutting programs even as they pay more. But I also think voters know this isn't going to happen overnight. This developed over 20 years, and it's going to continue to develop over 20 years. And they know that you know, institutions and schools are slow to turn. You know, voters need time to deliberate. They need a year to plan a budget at the very least. They need to have the right to consider any kind of governance change before they make it. And so this process does take a little time. I think what we're seeing is some signs that some of these conversations have started, and people really do see that we have to move forward and think about how we do school differently so that we can achieve what we want for our kids, but in a way that really respects our commitment to quality and equity. And in the interim, they realize they may have to support some high budgets until they get to a better place.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it the state's goal, though, when the kids move out of the house, that what you'd really have happen is the next-door couple whose kids also left would move in with you and you consolidate?
I agree. We're doing our bit. Every time I go to one of these national conferences with secretaries, I try to tell people they should move to Vermont. But, you know, I think part of that is making sure that we're a place where we're putting our money where it gets the biggest value for us as voters, where people are able to afford to come in and live in our communities, and where we have high quality jobs that those families with children can come and take, so that they can stay and live in our state and support their kids as they live here. This is a big issue. We can't fix this just with schools alone.
Right. Let me take one call. Let you go. Let's go to Cabot. Tony. Good morning.
Good morning. I have a question for the secretary on the performance end of the spectrum. Education seems to be quick to latch on to whatever's new and shiny, and sometimes they drop it, you know, like the new math, old math kind of thing. So my question is, is there a role for the agency in determining what sorts of academic programs work better than others? And how do you go about determining that? What kind of measurements do you use? What's the role for the agency?
Good question. Yeah.
I think that's an excellent question, and I think that goes right to the heart of what we worry about sometimes in our schools, which is, for all this investment, what are we getting back for it? And, you know, this is a local control state. We don't set curricula. We don't tell people what kinds of programs they have to use or what kind of instructional strategies they have to use. That's really a local decision in a local control state. What we do is work with the state board to help set quality standards or sort of performance standards for learning that we hope all students will meet. And those are really aspirational goals, what we'd like our students to know and be able to do. And then we try to develop a set of measures, because really it has to be more than one measure to try to track progress towards those. And some of the work that we're really focused on, in fact, I just came from a meeting downstairs where in the agency where we're bringing together stakeholders from different divisions to try to think about what it is when we look at the new education quality standards that were just approved by the State Board of Education, which really outlines several different areas of school quality that we're supposed to focus on. And one of them are the straightforward academic indicators that we've always had forever, that are driven in part and assessed in part by test scores, but also looking at issues around school climate and culture. And one of the things the agency is doing right now is piloting surveys for students and parents and teachers to get those three voices into a discussion of what a school is and what the quality of the school is. We're also looking at developing, and we're actually working with teams of teachers and educators across the state to develop and pilot and prototype a set of performance assessments of really transferable skills. It's that problem, that applied learning, problem-solving technology skill set that we know is so important to civic life when you're trying to figure out what to do with your budget, or business life when you're trying to figure out how to solve a complex problem that doesn't have an easy answer, so that we can encourage our schools in some systematic way to really challenge students to engage in this, but also to create from that some kind of public demonstration of learning that can be used as evidence with local community members and board members to begin to understand the quality of the schools. And then obviously we have test scores as well, which are one very powerful measure of learning in English language arts and math and science. And their power is that because it's the only test or measurement that we use systematically across schools, in addition to the school climate surveys we're piloting, it helps us evaluate things like our equity gap, who are we serving well, and who are we not serving so well statewide. And that kind of performance measure has really helped us identify that as a state, our big challenge right now is students in poverty, primarily students with disabilities, both of whom, even as other students are really achieving pretty substantial gains, those students really aren't making the kinds of improvements we want. And even more specifically, we see in our data that our schools have work to do in terms of engaging particularly young boys living in poverty, that somehow that's a group that we haven't figured out how to reach and to challenge and to reach the same level of performance that we'd hope for them.
Mm.
So, I think we need to continue to have this conversation. One of the things that we're trying to do with the agency is to pair really annual snapshots that pull together data profiles of each of our districts across school climate, student performance and academics, opportunities that systems provide for professional development and learning, because we know that's what makes a good school, is that teacher skill, and we need to figure out how to build it systematically, and also fiscal indicators and breadth and depth of opportunities to learn. Do you have a summer learning program, for example, for kids in poverty? Do you have a rich set of science offerings at the secondary level? Those kinds of data. But then beyond that, particularly because some of our systems are small, and so small that we have to suppress the data in some of them, to put together what we're calling an integrated field review, where we bring teams of teachers and educators across school sites to actually sit down, look at each, the system's local improvement plan, the goals it set for itself for improvement, to observe instruction, to look at discipline data, to look at decision-making and how it is aligning resources behind the stated priorities, and just give every system high-quality, both quantitative and qualitative feedback on its goals and on its progress towards those goals. Because at the end of the day, what really matters is how are we supporting our systems in improving the work they do with our children? And that's, we need to have a much more robust system to support that learning. So I think we have a lot of work to do there. We're pretty excited to have the education quality standards to stand on as we begin to do that work. And we really look forward to partnering with educators across the state and bringing them across school systems to see what their colleagues and other systems are doing, and to learn from each other and figure out how to better reach all of our children.
Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Holcomb is the Secretary of Education in the state of Vermont. We'll take a short break. We'll be back after this.
I'm a little concerned. As cold as it's been this winter, does anyone really want to go outdoors to play winter croquet?
But don't worry. If you hold the tournament, they'll come. One thing is for certain, the snow won't be melted by then.
What's the date of this year's Winter Croquet Tournament anyway?
Saturday, March 7th. The teams will gather at Rusty's Park at 7:30 in the morning. The tournament gets started at 8 o'clock, give or take a few minutes.
Pick up your entry form now at the offices of WDEV on Stowe Street in Waterbury for Winter Croquet 2015. This could be your year to win the legendary rotating Winter Croquet Trophy.
Has anyone seen the trophy lately?
Does anyone even remember who won it last year?
The Udder Guys.
The Udder Guys?
No, the Udder Guys. The Central Vermont Dairy Farmers won it last year. They're the defending champions.
Hope there's still snow on March 7th.
I don't think we'll have to worry too much about that.
Does anyone have a phone number for the Udder Guys?
That's the Udder Guys. Udder Guys.
Are you a Vermonter receiving Social Security benefits because of a disability? Are you working or trying to find employment? Disability Rights Vermont is a nonprofit organization with a mission to protect and advocate for the rights of people with disabilities. DRVT helps people that receive Social Security benefits to overcome obstacles to employment. DRVT has assisted Social Security beneficiaries in overcoming disability-based discrimination in the workplace, as well as addressing employment barriers related to problems with housing, transportation, or education. DRVT services are confidential and may include information, referral, advocacy, and legal representation. If you or someone you know receives Social Security disability benefits and is experiencing barriers to employment, please contact us at Disability Rights Vermont, 1-800-834-7890 or www.disabilityrightsvt.org.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk a little bit about brain development to begin the program. We'll have a guest to talk about that. You won't get that from me. Also coming up in our second hour tomorrow, we'll talk with some folks that are against that Vermont gas pipeline over in Addison County, the one that's still on the table, not the one that was canceled, obviously. So that'll be coming your way at about 10:15 on the program tomorrow. Moment of your time for our friends at Green Mountain Access. If you're looking for outstanding internet service, make it our local pals at gmavt.net. How would you like to have an email address that ends at gmavt.net, like mine? You can always email. I appreciate your thoughts, comments, and you can reach me at mark, M-A-R-K, at gmavt.net. If you'd like to call the folks at Green Mountain Access, they can make this switchover happen for you very quickly. They do all the hard work. You don't really have to lift a, you lift the phone. That's about all you do. And give them a call at 1-888-321-0815. That's 1-888-321-0815. If you, before you call, you might want to take a peek at their website. You may have a question or two already answered by the time you call. It may prompt another question or two that you hadn't even thought of. So maybe, you know, do just a little bit of research before you make that call. Depends on what you're looking for. If you're a business owner, my goodness, if you don't have a presence on the World Wide Web in 2015, I don't know how you're still in business, unless you're a business that, you know, really, you know, like the Luddite Society or something. Or if you're an individual, you know, you can opt out of the system here, or you can opt in, and you can do that by calling the folks at Green Mountain Access and getting yourself hooked up. And give them a call at 1-888-321-0815. And on the web at gmavt.net. Coming up Friday on the program, we're going to talk with the publisher of a local newspaper here in Montpelier, The Bridge. Nat Frothingham's going to join us. They have an interesting couple of financial things going on over there. We'll talk about the history of the paper and its future as well, too. Interesting couple of stories on the Vermont Digger site. One, I think, really just nicely framed what the situation is here in Vermont. Elizabeth Hewitt wrote this piece talking about the budget, and it was a program that she hones in on and talks about, and it's the headline, Programs That Target Criminal Recidivism Among the Mentally Ill Slated for Cuts. My goodness, if there's a problem I think we can all agree on in this state, that sometimes this merger between, you know, that the mentally ill, that the jails become kind of this place of last resort, that when there are not services that are available, people who are mentally ill get into trouble, they wind up in jail. And in many cases, that is just not the best place or the most appropriate place for them to be. So, you know, I think all of you are aware we have a deep financial problem currently today in the state of Vermont. The budget for the next year that starts on July 1 is one that they needed to fill a hole of about $100 million. So, you know, there are just going to be just scores of programs out there that get cut that are, you know, I would argue, and maybe many of you would too, are very valid programs that are these kinds of programs that you spend money now, and the theory is that you save money later. These programs here that are being talked about, the ones that would allow for caseworkers to actually establish relationships with people who are in communities, who are homeless, who are on the margins, who have mental illnesses. And when these caseworkers develop these relationships with these people, then they are less inclined to get into trouble. They have somebody there that can help them. There's somebody there that is providing them assistance and some guidance. There's a program called the Sparrow Project, which is down in Windsor County, and also the Collaborative Solutions Integration Project, which is done out of Washington County Mental Health. So these two programs, if they're eliminated, will save about 300,000 plus. Okay, that may be a good savings to get today, but here's where I worry about this, and maybe this is not the right way to think about it. But I look at this and I say to myself, that's what, six people in prison for a year right there? Wow. I don't know what the numbers are in this program. I don't know what I do know the numbers. The recidivism rate is about half. It's 17.9% compared to about 30% for people that don't participate in the programs. You got hundreds of people that have been through this program. I mean, presumably you could pick six people out here. So would you rather spend $50,000 on a bed in a jail? Or $50,000 and a couple of hundred grand on this? I don't know. That's going to wrap it up for today. Have a great day, everybody. Come back and join us tomorrow. FM 96.1 WDEV Warren and AM 550 WDEV Waterbury Montpelier. News is next. AP Radio.